Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. I saw a very fine cartoon in the New Yorker today. It's an elephant lying on the analyst's couch, and the caption said, "I can't believe it. I'm there in the living room, but it's as though nobody sees me." I'd never thought about the elephant in the living room from the elephant's point of view before. The Dhamma is a bit like the elephant in the living room, isn't it? It's the often it's, that image is used to refer to some aspect of life that we find is causing disturbance or is painful, and people don't want to talk about. But it's the same with the Dhamma in a way that it's right here in the room. This vast and potent presence, but yet somehow we keep missing it. We keep having our attention diverted by things that we like, things that we dislike, hope and fear, regret, success and failure, pain, excitement, all our different range of experiences that we have as human beings, that we miss the Dhamma because of our preoccupations. In a way, it's a monastery is a device to help notice the elephant of the Dhamma in the living room. Just the basic practices that we have and what we gather around, say today, here's the new moon day, Uposatha, and so we have an opportunity to gather together. We recited the training rules for the Bhikkhu Sangha this afternoon. Ajahn Yatiko did a very fine delivery, recitation of Patimokkha. 227 rules, and the novices, samaniras, anagarikas, all reiterated their commitment to their training this evening. The lay community resident and visiting determined their commitment to the eight precepts for this occasion, this night. So gathering together, chanting the puja, paying respect to the Triple Gem, Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, sitting silently together, directing the mind towards peacefulness, towards focus, towards wisdom, taking the precepts and then listening to Dhamma teachings and to reflect. And then the vigil through the rest of the night. There are thousands, tens of thousands, millions of different ways that human beings meet together and form a social bond. You can gather around all kinds of different things. You know, the can be just sitting down to watch TV together, or going to a family reunion, or going to the Elks, or the going to a bar, going to a movie, countless thousands, millions of different things that we as human beings can gather around and put our attention onto. But these various aspects of devotional practices, the recollection of the triple gem, Bhutanusati, Tamanusati, Sankhanusati, and meditation, precepts, listening to Dhamma, reflecting on Dhamma, and so on. These are all activities, principles that are designed to help us notice the Dhamma, realize the Dhamma, awaken to this presence that's here in the room, present that's here in our lives that we keep missing, even though its presence keeps making itself felt. The truth of the way that nature is, the way that life works, the truth of mind and body, the truth of the nature of the world. It keeps indicating its presence to us, rather like the elephant shuffling around, and and yet, even though the signals are there of impermanence and unsatisfactoriness and selflessness, we keep managing to ignore it. We keep buying into ideas of permanence and solidity, ideas of self-pursuing personal advantage, creating past and future, creating ourselves, creating other people, the whole array, captures our attention, and we keep missing it. Ever since the time of the Buddha, the practice of reaffirming the precepts and reaffirming the commitment to the Triple Gem has formed that basic engine of awakening to the Dhamma, of recollecting the Dhamma. That the Buddha established this kind of practice and this way of working in his own lifetime, and it's carried on since then, right down to today, and it still works as effectively as it ever has done. Because these are our ways that taking simple practices and attitudes, simple ideas and concepts, and by picking them up and recollecting them, bringing them into consciousness, choosing to focus our attention on that, then this brings the heart, brings our own lives into alignment with Dhamma. It helps us to notice what's here. So just reciting the verses of reverence, paying respect, honoring Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, reciting the words of the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and Sangha, bringing those to mind, bringing those into consciousness, and taking the precepts. Earlier today, when Ajahn Pasno was giving the reflection after the recitation to the monastic community, this is one of the things he was stressing was how Ajahn Chah focused more than anything else on two aspects of Dhamma practice, and these are sila and right view. And in a way, these two reflect each other or resonate each other. Or as one way of considering them is that they're an internal and an external aspect of the same fundamental quality. It's the same attitude of the heart, really. When there is right view internally, then the external activity and the way that we function in relationship to the world and to other beings is in accordance with sila. That's the external manifestation of that. And when we truly practice sila, and not just adjusting the behaviors, but sila not just as the behavior, but sila as the actual quality of heart as well, that quality of virtue in the heart. So, when sila is truly established, so that there's an obedience to the rules of, on the one hand, but also that's an obedience embedded in a genuine attitude of harmlessness and kindness, an attitude of honesty and restraint and so forth. Then that brings the quality of right view into being. It strengthens that, empowers that, clarifies that. So by taking the precepts, when it's not just a matter of learning how to pronounce the Pali words and learning how to them, bow properly and to recite the formulae and simply adopting the external forms of it, but it's an affirmation in the heart that these are bringing the nature of our life into alignment with Dhamma. Because when the heart is attuned to Dhamma, then it's impossible to deliberately take the life of another being, to cause harm, even unintentionally, is a painful thing. And that when one's taking the precepts and really establishes that in the heart as a fundamental attitude, then it's impossible to deliberately take the life of anything. Similarly, with the other precepts, that when the heart is truly attuned to Dhamma, then it's impossible to take things that don't belong to you, to be selfish and greedy and acquisitive. It just, the heart won't move in that direction. So it's useful to consider, say, on these occasions of the Upasaka day, when we formally take the precepts, whether it's the 227 or the 10 precepts or 8 precepts, to be working with the precepts in this way, to not just be recollecting the formulae, but to be exploring that, asking the question, how does this pattern of behavior affect me? How does it bring my life into alignment with Dhamma? Does it? What does this bring to have these rules or precepts or guidelines? What does it bring? How does it work? So we're exploring the principles and looking at that, so that we're internalizing the quality of sila. So it's not just a matter of controlling behavior, but it's also acting as a gateway, as an opening towards that, recognizing the inner quality, that genuine virtue of the heart that is the manifestation of Dhamma. When we've been having the readings recently, and the morning readings, one of those very brief passages from Ajahn Chah's teachings, when he's defining Dhamma, he says he describes it as purity, radiance, and peacefulness. So in a way, sila is that very quality of purity, that like nobility of intent, that quality of gentleness, respectfulness, kindliness. Aware that purity stems from, essentially, is with right view established as its source. That in a way, this is the first element of the Eightfold Path, because this is really how the the heart can attune itself to Dhamma. It's the first step, the first link in a way. And so that the internal aspect that Ajahn Chah would stress is that of right view. So externally, living according to sila, internally establishing right view. And as the Buddha said, right view is the forerunner of all wholesome states. There's nothing so conducive to happiness, to peace, as right view. And similarly, the opposite teaching, there's nothing so conducive to suffering as lack of peace as wrong view. When right view is talked about, there's different ways that it's described, and one of those aspects is seeing in terms of the Four Noble Truths. That can be a little bit hard to relate to or to imagine, a little hard to get a sense for. But it's not an intellectual position that one is trying to take. Establishing the heart in right view, it's not just a memory exercise or trying to think of the Four Noble Truths and figure out some way that they can be applied as a description of every internal and external experience. It's not so much that. It's more developing a manner of feeling. A manner of apprehending the world of our mind, the world of the senses. And that, and when we think of a principle like seeing in terms of the Four Noble Truths, seeing the Four Noble Truths, in terms of experience, that manner of apprehending, it boils down to seeing all experience in terms of dukkha and the ending of dukkha. And so I often say, when people are asking about different kinds of meditation practice or what are the benefits or blessings of different kinds of meditation practice, and again, Ajahn Pasana was pointing out this, that why did Ajahn Chah stress so much sila and right view? Wasn't he a bit more specific about the right meditation method or particular meditation techniques or a single Ajahn Chah method? But more that right view and sila were the Ajahn Chah method. And oftentimes when people ask me about different meditation objects or practices or different styles, that I'll often say that fundamentally, all meditation boils down to the development of dukkha as the meditation object, dukkha, and then its absence. That's really what it boils down to. And pretty much any kind of technique, any methodology, that's what it devolves to. It's just getting a sense for. Noticing when there is dukkha, when there is that stress, that tension, that dissonance in our experience, that discord. But it's like any kind of skill, like learning a musical instrument or learning cookery or learning chanting or whatever it might be, any kind of skill, learning how to use a saw, learning how to ride a bicycle, that you're developing a certain sensitivity. You're training the mind. So if you're trying to handle a saw, you learn to pay attention to your grip. You learn to pay attention to the grain of the wood. You learn to pay attention to the angle of the saw blade. If you're learning how to cook, you pay attention to the different fruits and vegetables. You learn how the different utensils, knives and choppers and graters, such like, work, and how the different things respond to heat and water and oil and so on. You have to study the materials and learn how the processes work. So you're training your attention to a particular pattern of changes, a particular ordering of things. And so learning to see in terms of right view, training the heart to see in terms of right view, is learning to recognize the quality of dukkha, that discord in the heart, that sense of dislocation, that feeling of wrongness, not quite rightness, of things being out of kilter, the wheel not spinning truly. So whether it happens to be a thought or a memory or an emotion, it happens to be something that we see or some task that we're engaged in or some way that we are relating to our own body or to the world around us or whatever it might be, whether it's something that's conventionally internal or external, coarse or fine, near or far, pure or impure, sacred or profane, beside the point. Whether it's a thing that you're doing or a thing that's happening to you or a thing that's being remembered or anticipated or whatever it might be. If it's a thing, if it's an experience of any kind, whether it's extraordinarily subtle and fine, whether it's incredibly pleasant and delightful, whether it's painful and difficult, turbulent, burdensome. Training the heart to see in terms of right view is recognizing, seeing that the crucial element is that of, is there dukkha here? Is there no dukkha? And we begin to see that whether it's an internal experience or an external experience, can be extremely painful or extremely blissful. And we see, well, that's not the crucial factor, that there can be extraordinary degrees of physical pain, but no dukkha, no suffering on account of it, the mind not making a problem of it. Something can be extremely pleasant, delightful. You get exactly what you want. Things are blissfully pleasing. And yet we see that the mind can create a problem out of it. We can create dukkha from that pleasant experience. So it's training the senses in a way. It's developing a skill. So it's not like a cultivatedly sour attitude towards life. Like whatever you see, you just think dukkha. It's all dukkha. It's all misery. And just developing a reflexive response, just a blanket label to make everything sour and unpleasant. That's not what is meant. It's developing an acuity of attention to notice that discord, just like an orchestral conductor, someone conducting a whole orchestra. If they develop their hearing well enough, then this one of the second violins is out of tune. Oh, they need to tighten that drum in the timpani. That's too loose. They need to fix that. That we train the sense to notice that discord. And then in noticing that discord, that tension, then it's not a matter of dwelling on it, because it's not just the first noble truth that is the substance of right view. It's all four. They're a set. And so that in seeing that tension, in feeling that, and noticing the dukkha in something mundane, in something pleasant, in something unwanted, then recognizing that as being dukkha, then seeing that it's coming from a cause. Its cause then is the quality of craving. Kama tanna, bhava tanna, vibhava tanna, the different kinds of craving and clinging. There's some attachment going on. So then when the dukkha is seen, well, even regardless how subtle it might be, then there's that exploration into Where's this coming from? If there's dukkha, then there's got to be some attachment going on. Now, where's the clinging? And that's where the element of wisdom and investigation has to be applied. Dhamma vijaya, an exploring of experience, looking into it, seeing what's there. And this is one of the powerful truisms of practice, is that whenever there's dukkha, there's always clinging, that's the cause. And so that developing the practice of right view, developing that, is developing that reflex of, if there's dukkha, rather than having the response, complain, or get guilty, or blame, or seek an out, find some excuse to get away from this particular feeling, that recognizing those habitual worldly reactions, to instead divert the attention to the cause. Where does this come from? And then we see, and it can be 10,000 different nuances of that, of clinging. It can be fear of a particular pain that we think we're going to experience, or a painful memory that comes from remembering a mistake that was made in the past, or something that we said or did that had uncomfortable results that caused us to be criticized or hurt or wounded or whatever it might be. So seeing where the clinging is, and then in a way the path, the fourth noble truth, silasam, which is boiled down from the eightfold path down to the three qualities of virtue, concentration, wisdom, in a way that boils down to the way that the second noble truth is to be handled, that when there's clinging, then the response that's appropriate to that is pahata banti, to let go. Pahana, to relinquish, to let go. It should be let go of. And then in that, developing that response, then it has been let go of. So seeing where the clinging is. And that one of the interesting and wonderful things is that when we genuinely develop right view, we develop this wisdom faculty, then that very seeing of the clinging is the agent whereby we break its hold. You can't keep a good grasping going. You can't sustain a good cling if you're watching it. It's like I often symbolize this by saying it's really hard to stay distracted and preoccupied if the Buddha walks into the room. If you're busy with some stupid distraction, and then the Buddha walked into the room, then you'd immediately feel like, okay, I'll put this down now. I don't really need to be paying attention to this, or reading this paper, or having this conversation, because the Buddha just walked in. Oh. So when that wisdom faculty is there, that's just like the Buddha walking into the room, isn't it? When the mind is clinging to the fear of a pain, or the fantasy of some pleasant experience, or some nostalgic memory, or some long-nursed resentment, be nursing your wrath, imagining some revenge on someone who done you wrong, whatever it might be, the mind stewing away, brewing up some wonderful rearrangement or reiteration of the past or future, And then suddenly there's the Buddha walks into the room, and that very vision, that very knowing quality, just seeing the feeling the tension that's there in getting wrapped up in that memory or that fantasy, that fear, that aversion, that busyness, that obsessive interest. At least my experience is that it's impossible to keep it going. That you feel, you know the discomfort of that, the pressure of that, the tension of it, and there doesn't even have to be the thought, I should let go of this. It's like in the Four Noble Truths in the Dhammacakka Sutta, when the Buddha's describing this, right, in his very first Dhamma teaching on this theme, he said, there is the cause of dukkha, it should be abandoned, it needs to be abandoned, and it has been abandoned. So the more that we practice in this way, we develop this, then the more it becomes a natural process, that in seeing, feeling the quality of clinging, just letting it be known, not even, I should get rid of this, I have to do something about this, I've got a terrible habit of longing for this and fearing that and resenting this and delighting in that, obsessing on this and worrying about that. I should. That's seen as totally superfluous. Just gently and steadily bringing the light of wisdom onto the knotted tangle of clinging. Then just like a heat lamp working on a knotted muscle, or the putting the bottles of Naman Mo Singh out in the into the sunshine, there's a melting. The solidified wax melts in the sun. The knotted muscle untangles and unknots itself, relaxes, softens. Dukkha ceases. There's dukkha nirodha. So cultivating right view is not a particularly complicated process at all. It's developing this eye, this feel for the habit of clinging and the tension of dukkha that comes from that. Oh, another of the teachings Ajahn Pasno was bringing up earlier on was about the Buddha's teaching on the ideal solitude and how when addressing a particular monk who was keen on doing everything by himself and alone, liked to live alone and go on alms round alone and eat alone, meditate alone, do everything by himself, and praise that. I'm not quite sure who he was praising it to. He must have been with somebody, some others, unless he was sitting by himself giving Dhamma talks to himself in his kuti, which of course is possible. This can happen. But then the Buddha explained, well, if you really want to develop solitude, it's not just a matter of the kaya viveka, the physical seclusion. That's only one part of it. That's the coarsest kind of seclusion. But inner seclusion, jitta viveka, the internal solitude is far more beneficial, more important, more refined. And then he gives this wonderful teaching about time, really. About developing true seclusion is then a seclusion from past and future. So he takes that principle of solitude and he says, well, when you consider this internally, what does that amount to? What does that come from? What is that internally? Solitude. And this is a very wonderful and refined teaching in some ways, but very practical too. Because when we look at that, when we consider that, that teaching, what the Buddha is saying is time is dukkha. If we reify time, if we make past and present and future into solid realities in our imagination, then we create dukkha. Because the Dhamma is akaliko, is timeless. Apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation, as we all recited together this evening. If the reality is timeless, then if the mind imagines time to be real, past and future and present to be solid and real, then necessarily we are believing in a reality that does not exist. We're buying into an imaginary version of reality, which is not valid, it's not true. So, dukkha. So that right view in this respect is recognizing that the past has no solidity, that everything that we know about the past is experienced here and now, in this present moment. Everything that has happened, it either exists as a memory that arises here and now, or as the collection of effects of all the past causes. The way our bodies are is the result of all the air that we've breathed and the food and drink that we've consumed and the different activities that we've performed. And our genetic makeup, it's a collection of past causes have arrived at to this particular pattern now. So when the Buddha says letting go of the past, what is in a way it's more accurate to say letting go of your delusion about the past, because there isn't really a past that exists to be taken hold of. There isn't anything there. It's the mind imagines this collection of images and then tries to go off and inhabit them. So when we buy into the nostalgic feelings, remembering pleasant experiences or taking some unpleasant or mediocre experiences and rewriting them so that it would be much more pleasant if I'd have done this and he'd said that and she'd done this and I'd gone there and I hadn't done that, and if I'd only passed that exam then. Regrets, feelings that we feel, things that we feel guilty about, that things that we did that were painful to others or painful to ourselves, or resentments, wrongs that have been experienced. It's all dependent on creating a solid idea of a past and then going off and inhabiting it. But all of those resentments and the nostalgia, the regrets, the memories, neutral, painful, pleasant, memory is experienced now. It doesn't happen anywhere else. All of the results of every past effect are gathered here now, in these bodies, in this building, in this time. This is the result of everything that's happened in the universe to this point. It's like this. Exactly this way, this moment. This is the past is known now. Everything, the result of every event, great and small, is this. And similarly the future. And the Buddha says, letting go of the past, letting go of the future, to establish the ideal solitude. Where is the future? It's just the imagined pictures that the mind creates out of the potential that's present in this moment, in these bodies, these minds, this world, this material, mental matrix of forces and influences and elements. What we imagine, everything that we long for, any desire object, it's off in the imagined future. When I get hold of that, when I get to that place, when I get to be like that, when I get away from this. Any object of fear, fear is about time, isn't it? What might happen to me? Desire is about time, what I might get hold of, what I want to get hold of, what I haven't got yet that I want to get, to become, to get rid of. Fear is about time. Desire is about time. Aversion, wanting to change this so it'll be different. Wanting this aspect of my body or my mind to be different. Get rid of this. I wish this was different, then I would be happy. I wish this other person would be different, then I would be happy. I wish the weather or the place or the country and my family or the government was different. This pain in my leg or my back. So when we consider it, these are all based on time, aren't they? An imagined past and an imagined future. If I could just get hold of this then, if I could just get rid of this then, if I could just avoid that happening then. Even if it's over just very brief spans of time, just a few seconds of the past to a few seconds in the future, still that tension of dukkha is there. This is how it works. It's fear of what might be coming, desire for what might be coming, aversion. The whole thing hinges upon remembering, anticipating, imagining. And then also the Buddha talks about in these kind of teachings, letting go of the past, letting go of the future, and then not creating false views about or mistaken views about the self. Not establishing views relating to the self in the present moment. So that's the third element, in a way, of establishing this right view. So not even just solely based around time, letting go of time, letting go of self, the feeling of I. Because even if there's a letting go of past and future and that's really been dropped, still the mind can create a me that's here in this present moment. A letting go of views about the self here in the present moment. Because that also is a generator of dukkha, that is also a source of that same kind of tension, the same discord. Here, there, subject, object, me, you, the self and the world. So even if it's subtle kinds of dukkha that we experience, just training ourselves to notice that, seeing where the mind moves towards these very basic and primordial objects. And using this as a clue that the mind has just drifted from right view. Maybe starting from a point of clear vision, of vijja, of knowing, then it's when we are unmindful, when the attention drifts and slips, we don't notice. There's not a clear indication within us that that the mind is drifting off into wrong view, into buying into ideas and feelings, perceptions and so forth. But to develop and to establish right view, and these are simple markers, flags that we can use, that if the mind is moving towards to praising another or admiring another, criticizing another, then just seeing that, oh, there's a perception of self and other has grown up. That's a clue. There's some clinging going on. The mind just bought into self and other. If the mind moves towards time, moves into time, fearing something, desiring something, regretting something, feeling guilty about something, just developing that as a signal. Oh, I just created time again. Where is the past? Where is the future? Where does it happen? So these are simple ways that we can support the establishment, cultivation of right view. And it's things that can easily slip by because our perceptive habits are geared to not noticing that. Self and other, of course. I'm me, I'm Ajahn Amaro, and I'm not you. And yeah, Ajahn Pasano isn't you either. He and I are not each other. Different people, of course. Common sense. So this is developing uncommon sense that takes the evidence of the eye and the ear and the nose and the tongue, the body and the mind, the thinking mind, and recognizing these are not to be trusted. These are not the whole story. As in another of those suttas we were reading, when Mara says to the Buddha, "The eye is mine. The ear is mine, the nose is mine, the tongue is mine, the body is mine, the mind is mine." And the Buddha doesn't argue. He says, yes, the mind is yours, the eye is yours, evil one. The ear, nose, tongue, body, they are yours, evil one. But where the eye can't go, where the ear can't go, and so on. That you do not know of, evil one. You don't even know what that's referring to. So this is the uncommon sense of right view, where we are recognizing the habitual patterns of self and other, me and the world, the habitual patterns of past, present, future. Today is the new moon day. It's an observance day. It's a day. It has to do with time. This is... Every day is not the new moon day. Every day is not the observance day. It's a Thursday, 6-day week, this one. This is a ordinary structures of time. It's night time. It's Thursday. It's March. As a matter of fact, as me and you and the names that we have and all of those worldly details. But those are the things that belong to Mara. Those are the khandhas, the conditioned formations of the world, mental and physical. They belong to Mara. But that where Mara cannot go, where he does not even cannot even conceive, this is what the teaching is pointing to. That's where the Dhamma is to be found. So it takes some effort to steer the attention to that, to pick up those flags, to notice those flags, and to bring the attention to that, and to follow that through. To notice the tension in the heart that comes when we buy into time. A past, my future. It's even in the subtlest way, it's just even in meditation when the mind is quite refined, just that leaning towards what the next moment might bring, more of this good stuff, or maybe this thing is going to fade away, or maybe... to totally abandon the illusion of time, then brings the heart into accord with Dhamma, Akaliko, the Akaliko Dhamma, Pachupana Dhamma, the here and now Dhamma. When we reflect on time in a very direct, focused way, we begin to see that in the heart is really open to this moment. There's no thing that can come from the past to arrive in this moment. There's no thing from this moment that can transmit itself to the future. Losing this, getting that, they all don't make sense anymore. They're worldly perceptions. To the thinking mind, the conceptual mind, this can seem sort of bizarre or peculiar, irrelevant. But in terms of ending suffering, in terms of realizing Dhamma, this is a crucial insight. There's a rendering of the passage in the Sixth Patriarch Sutra, which says, in this moment, there is nothing which comes to be. In this moment, there is nothing which ceases to be. Therefore, in this moment, there is no birth and death to be brought to an end. Therefore, this moment is the absolute peace. And though it is only this moment, there is no limit to this moment. And herein is eternal delight. That's a very powerful and wonderful teaching, isn't it? Because we think of this moment as this, the present, just like a tiny filament between a vast, immeasurable past in an inconceivably long period of time into the past, and the future, inconceivably vast stretches of time off into the future. And the present is this little insignificant, you know, razor-thin line of nowness. But what this that teaching points to, and what the just naming the Dhamma, recognizing, reflecting on the Dhamma as akaliko, timeless, it's pointing to the fact that rather than the past and the future being these infinitely vast, powerful presences, they are the ephemeral, flimsy, insubstantial side pieces, and the present is this infinite, spacious quality. In this moment, there is no thing which comes to be. How can a thing pass from a past into a now? In this moment, nothing ceases to be. A thing that is now that then moves into to stopping. Arising takes time. Passing away takes time. So that arising and passing away is dependent on the idea of a real thing. When the attention is perfectly attuned to Dhamma, then there's a recognition, well, there isn't really anything which arises. There isn't anything which passes away. That's why in Lumpo Sumedho's teachings, Ajahn Pasno and I got a very sweet letter from Tony Anthony today, and he said he was happy, delighted to receive an unexpected gift of Lumpur Sumedho's book, The Sound of Silence, in the mail from us. And he said, "Well, I've dug into it to a few chapters so far, and it's like this." which is a phrase that's repeated hundreds of times during the course of the book. It's like this. There's thisness, isness. A principle that that Lumpur points to over and over again. And the words start to be incapable of really conveying this quality. Isness, suchness, thusness, thisness. Isness is our business. You run out of ways of trying to refer to it. But just taking that simple principle of recognizing that thingness, time, these are all synonymous with dukkha. Sabbe sankhara dukkha, all conditioned things are dukkha. It's not the Buddha having a sour outlook on life and complaining about everything. Everything is suffering. Everything disappoints me. It's more just saying that if it's a thing, there is dukkha. Thingness is dukkha. Time is dukkha. And that even the subtle kinds of tension, discord in the heart are recognized, then there's dukkha nirodha. There's no dukkha. Suffering ceases. That perception of discord is resolved. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening. Pandamayam dhamma kataya sadhuka.